This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's interviews with Curb Your Enthusiasm's Jeff Garlin and author Jasmine Ward, both of whom take a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump is so desperate for literally any kind of positive achievement that he is now outright lying about the fate of his health care bill and his new tax plan. But there's one major obstacle standing in the way of Trump's domestic agenda. He has no idea what he's talking about. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. When you've had as many policy failures as Trump has, you start to become desperate for ways to score points with your base. And for Trump, that means repeatedly doubling down on his feud with NFL players who kneel during the national anthem. Polls have shown that Trump's comments are deeply unpopular, and yet, despite the backlash, the president is apparently very proud of himself.
Sources tell CNN that the president appears pleased with the firestorm he's created, telling a private dinner of conservative leaders, "It's really caught on."
It's really caught on? You're talking about a racial controversy, not the Macarena. Trump, of course, has tweeted obsessively about the NFL while saying much less about the growing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico. And you can tell that the president's unhinged tweeting is beginning to haunt his staff. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders tried to refocus the media's attention back on the president's agenda and away from his tweets on Monday, but I feel like she might have hurt her cause when she accidentally came up with a new nickname for Trump.
It's not lost on the president or his administration that there is more work to do. We need better schools, and we need better jobs to provide a safer, stronger, more prosperous future for every American. President Trump is working to make America great again for all of our citizens.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did she just call him President Chirp?
President Chirp?
Yeah. Although I always thought of him as more of a President Screech. You know, I almost feel bad for Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She always sounds like she's at a parent-teacher conference for the kid who keeps trying to burn down the school. I know, but you never talk about the things he doesn't burn down. Trump, of course, has continued to double down throughout the week, not just in arguing that players should stand for the anthem, but insisting that the NFL write a rule requiring players to stand or face punishment.
I think it's a very important thing for the NFL to not allow people to kneel during the playing of our national anthem.
So the president wants NFL players fired for exercising their right to free speech, and yet, on the very same day, Trump's own attorney general was across town talking about free speech on college campuses and said this.
In this great land, the government does not tell you what to think or what to say.
As long as you're not kneeling while you're thinking or saying it. And, by the way, I would think Sessions would be fine with people kneeling. Then at least he'd be at their eye level. That is a very interesting haircut. For Trump, of course, it's much easier to whip up anger against football players than it is to talk about complex policy because he doesn't know anything about policy. Of course, a third option is just to lie, as Trump did yesterday when he bizarrely claimed to reporters that the GOP did, in fact, have enough votes to pass their failed health care bill, which GOP leaders have already pulled after three Republican senators said they would vote no. Trump kept insisting falsely that the real reason the GOP couldn't pass their health care bill was that there was a mysterious, unnamed senator in the hospital who could not make it to the Senate floor to vote, baffling the reporters in attendance.
We have one senator that's in the hospital. He can't vote because he's in the hospital. He can't vote because he's in the hospital. I'm almost certain we have the votes. But with one man in the hospital, we cannot display that we have them. We can't do it now because we have somebody in a hospital.
Sir, who's in the hospital? What senator are you referring
to? He can't come here and vote. In other words, he can't come here and vote because he's in the hospital.
Who is in the hospital, sir?
We're only one off, maybe two. But we can't vote now, John. You probably didn't hear me because, as you know, one of our yes votes is in the hospital.
What are you talking about? I'm starting to think the next time you have a chance, you might want to consider dropping by a hospital. Just some of the basic tests, you know. Reporters later figured out that Trump might have been referring to Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran, who was not in the hospital but was at home dealing with a health issue. After Trump's comments, Cochran was forced to release a statement assuring people he was okay. Thanks for the well wishes. I'm not hospitalized, but am recuperating at home in Mississippi and look forward to returning to work soon. This is how bad things are now. The president spread so many insane rumors, senators have to issue statements letting everyone know they're okay. This is the first presidency where you have to check in safe on Facebook. It's only a matter of time before Rand Paul has to tweet, "Thanks for the support. Contrary to the president's comments, I did not fall down a well and get trapped for days and have not been forced to eat rats to stay alive." But I do believe he was being honest when he said he was psyched about it. In addition to its massive unpopularity, Trump's lack of familiarity with his own health care bill is partially what doomed it. For example, when Trump spoke about the bill last week, there were lots of questions Americans wanted to hear him answer. Would the bill protect pre-existing conditions? Would the bill gut Medicaid? Would premiums rise? Instead, this is all Trump could offer voters.
I must be honest with you. Whether it happens or not, something's going to happen, and it's going to be positive.
Good Lord. You get more specifics from the palm reader at the county fair. You lost someone very important to you with a vowel in their name? Grandpa Joe? Yes, Grandpa Joe. A few days later, Trump tried to dispel the notion that he hasn't been very involved in the GOP's healthcare efforts. But if anything, he made clear why he's been so bad at this.
For 7 years, I've been hearing repeal and replace. So I'm very much involved. You know, they like to say, well, Mr. Trump, President Trump, sat in the Oval Office and didn't. I'm on the phone screaming at people all day long for weeks.
I love Trump's impression of a smart person. And they always say, oh, Mr. Trump, take your head out of the oven. And I'm like, that's where the food is. How else am I going to get my food? It's really sad. So with the failure of his health care plan, Trump is now moving on to tax cuts. And again, when it comes to taxes, Trump is either clueless or lying or both. In fact, the political strategy for Trump's tax plan seems to be this. Pretend that it doesn't slash taxes for the wealthy, even though it very obviously does. Under Trump's plan, the wealthy will pay only 35% on their income taxes, down from 39.6%. That, of course, flies in the face of promises Trump made repeatedly, both during the campaign and as president. In fact, just this month, he insisted that not only would the wealthy not get a tax cut, their taxes might actually go up under his plan.
The rich will not be gaining at all with this plan.
Will wealthy have higher taxes?
I think the wealthy will be pretty much where they are. Pretty much where they are. If we can do that, we'd like it. If they have to go higher, they'll go higher, frankly.
The only way he was raising taxes on the rich was if he could pick which rich people. Rosie, she's gonna get her taxes raised. Meryl Streep's gotta start paying her fair share. everyone in the NBA except for the tall white guys. Because they are the backbone of this great nation. Now, if you have trouble believing that Trump and his cronies would so brazenly enrich themselves at the expense of hardworking taxpayers, you need look no further than the ongoing scandal surrounding Trump's health secretary, Tom Price. Politico reported this week that Price has spent more than $400,000 on taxpayer-funded private jet travel since May, including a $17,760 round trip on a charter jet to Nashville, where Price stayed less than 6 hours and had lunch with his son. How do you fly somewhere, have lunch, and fly back in 6 hours? Do you take the jet to the drive-thru window? Now, today, Price said he'd pay some of that money back to the government, but only the cost of his seat on the flights, not the full cost of the $400,000 to charter those flights. A Health and Human Services official said Price would write a check for about $52,000, which appears to cover the cost of his seat. You're only paying for your seat. You're the one who chartered the flights in the first place. That's like inviting your entire workplace out for drinks and then saying, so I only had 2 beers. Here's $9. So we have a clueless president lying about his plans while he attacks athletes for peaceful protests. If you've ever wondered who's the most incompetent president in modern times, I think we now know the answer.
President Trump.
It is President Trump. And then a closer look. We talked about it on the show this week, last Sunday, what happened with the anthem protests, what happened with Trump's criticism of players who kneel during the national anthem, and it's led me to reflect on my relationship with football, and more importantly, my relationship with the Pittsburgh Steelers, who I deeply, deeply love. I love the Steelers so much that I'm fairly embarrassed by it. I think about them way too much. They affect my emotions way too much. What's really embarrassing, I am not from Pittsburgh. My dad is from Pittsburgh, and one of the things he ingrained in my brother and I was this love for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Here's how much my dad loves the Pittsburgh Steelers. If sometimes my dad will say, hey, I have a friend, and he wants to come to the show. Can you get him a couple tickets? And I always do that, and then afterwards I'll go back and talk to that person. And one of the things I'll always say is, hey, how do you know my dad? And at least once a month, that person will say to me, oh, I was wearing a Steelers hat at a restaurant, and he he just walked over and started talking to me. And then they talk long enough that it ends with them getting tickets to this show. And that's great. That's what I love about football. Everybody, a sports fan of any team, is that you connect with strangers. You feel an emotional connection. I also love that because football doesn't really matter, it allows you to have a real emotion about fake things. For example, because I'm a Steelers fan, I hate the Patriots. Now, I don't really hate the Patriots. I just fake hate them for sports reasons. But I really hate the Patriots. But, you know, I don't hate people who like the Patriots. For example, our cue card guy, Wally, he loves the Patriots, and I love Wally. Yeah, give it up for Wally. Even though I would say 2 to 3 days a week, he wears a Patriots shirt as if to mock me. We had an actual Patriot on our show, Julian Edelman. Here's a photo of him. He was just a lovely guy. We had a wonderful time. He gave me a Patriots hat, which I promptly threw in the garbage. That's not true. Wally asked me for it, and I told Wally, buy your own hat. And then I threw it in the garbage. But the thing is, I hate the Patriots, but also I don't, but I really do. And I also love the Steelers so much that I love the players. I genuinely love, again, this is all irrational. I understand this is all irrational. I love players that I've never met, that I've never spoken to. But I will say, what I realized this week is because I love these players, it would be crazy for me not to want to hear what they wanted to express, the actual feelings they had as human beings. It would be crazy to just love them as players and not the humanity of them. So for me, you know, when someone uses their platform to peacefully protest something important to them, I have a great deal of respect for that. Now, a lot of people are saying, there is a better time and place than during the national anthem at a football game to protest. But the thing about protests is you do them at a time where the maximum amount of people pay attention to them. And that's why it is the right time to talk about something that's important to you. No one, you never hear someone say, like, we should protest. Where? Quietly in my parents' basement. What do we want? Equality. Why do we want it now? What are you two doing down there? Ah! Pledge of Allegiance. The Steelers, what's interesting about the Steelers is they have a player on their team who is an Army veteran. He actually served in Afghanistan. His name's Alejandro Villanueva. And he's a really interesting person to listen to this week, or at least I found him interesting to listen to, because he was both, you know, in the Army, and he's now on a football team. And something that he seems to understand that President Trump doesn't is that when a player takes a knee in silent, peaceful protest during the national anthem, they're protesting racial injustice, and they're not saying anything about the troops. They're not saying anything about not loving this country. And I would think that when you have someone with that depth of experience of having lived in both those worlds, that would be somebody worth listening to. The other thing is, I think there's this idea that people like football more and sports in general when they're not complicated, but particularly with NFL football. NFL football didn't get complicated on Sunday. It's been complicated for a while. I think in order to watch the NFL, in order to love it as much as I do, you have to get over a lot of things that are true about the sport. And so because of that, you know, it's too late for me. I'm always going to love football. I'm always going to love the Steelers. But I have a son now, and I have a chance to maybe not indoctrinate him the way my father indoctrinated me. I have not made that choice. I'm going all in. For example, I am in a three-strike football pool. You basically pick one team every week, and you're allowed to be wrong three times over the course of the season. And I decided to let my year-and-a-half-old son, Ash, pick the teams this year. Now, obviously, at 18 months, he's not great with what teams are better than others. So what I did was I bought 32 tiny plastic football helmets, and I put them in a bag. And once a week, I try to get him to take one of them out, and that's the pick. The only problem is I cannot, for the life of me, get him to only take out one helmet at a time, as evidenced by this.
Just one. Just one. Look, just give me one. Ash, give me one. Give Dad that one. Okay, it is the Panthers. Oh, my God. Thank you. But it was the Panthers. You gave me the Panthers.
I cannot tell you how much I love that. And the Panthers lost, so he's not even good at it. I should say, afterwards, I immediately packed them back up, and I put them away, and he lost his mind. And my wife said, you have to let him play with them now. Because, of course, to him, they were just colorful pieces of plastic. He didn't see what it was, like, gambling implications of it. So I guess the question is why, with everything, do am I just full bore going into this world where I want my son to love football as much as I do? In 2005, my entire family, my parents, my brother, and I, we went to the Super Bowl in Detroit. The Pittsburgh Steelers, who had not won a Super Bowl for a very long time, won in the Super Bowl in 2005. And my dad, there's things called terrible towels, which Steeler fans wave at football games. And my dad just started crying into the terrible towel. And of all the times I've seen my father cry, it is my favorite because it is the only time I've seen my mother cry. And I think about it all the time and how happy it made me and how it is, you know, for us. And again, it's irrational. I'm not saying there's any reason that anyone who isn't doing this should do it. But it's become such a family thing, and it means so much to me. So, you know, I would just say that things that are important to me, a peaceful protest, very important to me. I hope it stays around forever. I hope football stays around forever. I do think the NFL should get rid of the Patriots, and I'm not alone in that. They're bad people. They're not. I'm just kidding, but they're really awful. And, Wally, you should be ashamed of yourself and buy your own hat. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm really looking forward to Sunday. So thank you guys so much for listening to me.
Ryan Reese, audience warmer comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers, here with Brendan from New York. How do you feel about President Trump's handling of the relief efforts in Puerto Rico?
I mean, I think it's been pretty obvious he's done a pretty poor job. If you kind of look at what he's been dealing with lately with just babbling about the NFL versus while this crisis is going on when a lot of people don't even have water, don't have food, they're drowning, it's pretty evident that the fact that he didn't react immediately, it's a pretty poor job.
Seth touched on the NFL players voicing their opinion by taking a knee during the national anthem. What's your opinion on the controversy? How do you feel?
I mean, I'm 100% pro them taking the knee. Honestly, the fact that he kind of put his foot down and started yelling about it brought a lot of attention to the issue and obviously helped them unite even further and had a lot of guys step up and agree with what Colin Kaepernick was doing. So I think at the end of the day, you know, they're spreading their word even more, and it's only gotten better from there.
Thanks for joining us, man.
Our guest is a very funny actor and comedian you know from shows like The Goldbergs and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He returns to Curb for its ninth season this Sunday night on HBO. Please welcome to the show Jeff Garlin, everybody. Hi, Jeff.
Hello there, Seth.
It's so good to see
How
you.
How are you?
I'm good. So, I do want to ask about this because I notice you have a camera.
Uh-huh.
Because we have a set photographer right there that does this.
But I have a point of view that he doesn't get.
That's true.
Yes, and I have every talk show host going.
You have them all. So this
History
is something
of it, yes.
And you just make sure you never forget your camera when you come on a talk show.
No, I forget it plenty of times.
Okay, guys. I'm glad you remembered it for me.
Oh, not going to forget for you, Seth.
How are you? Is everything well?
Everything's a big bowl of wonderful.
Good.
Two TV shows premiering the same week.
So exciting.
Goldberg's on last night.
Uh-huh.
And then, yes. A very popular show.
Very popular show.
With young people and old. And then...
Two very important demos.
By the way.
Yeah.
And there's like 1 year in between. I think
nobody cares for it.
48.
48, like, it's not for them.
Not for them.
Yeah.
And then Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah. Yes.
And has it been, how many years since season 8? Has it been 6 years or something?
That's what I hear.
And so
I don't pay attention. I'm busy.
So I imagine, though, that the last 6 years of your life, people have constantly been asking you, will there be another new season of Curb?
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you happy that that's now not a thing that people will be asking you?
Yeah, I'm looking for new things for them to ask me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I would do, actually, if someone, you know, really was asking me, like, I would give a percentage, a true percentage. Like, I would go 68, 71.
Oh, like what
really,
you thought the
what
odds
I
were.
Felt, what I felt, yes. Yeah. And now I say 100%.
You say 100, but just for this one that's about to come right now.
Yes.
As for the one after this.
The one after that, I will go with... I'll go with 49%.
49%. Yes. Okay. So just...
They'll take it.
Just beneath...
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's exciting.
Yeah, it'll build as it goes.
You've known Larry for a long time. You've known Larry since he was a stand-up.
Yes, we were stand-ups in New York together.
Susie Essman as well, right?
Yes, I knew Susie Essman as a stand-up in New York.
What are your memories of Larry as a stand-up in the early days?
As Larry as a stand-up? Well, first off, no, it's true. Hilarious, and I'm so scared that I have chocolate here.
You don't.
Okay. Why do you put cookies in the room? I don't need cookies before I come out.
We thought you would want to take a still life.
No.
That was all for...
No, if I stay out here too long, I'll fall asleep now.
Yeah, that's true.
Larry was... he was a comedian's comedian. Comedians loved him, and audiences would vary in their love.
Yeah.
And then he would vary in his love for them. He actually... I saw him do this. He went on stage, looked in the eyes, and went... No, I don't think so. And then left. No, I saw him do it. No, yeah. And he'd look at people. If you looked at him weird or said something, it was kind of fun. See, I wanted him to keep going because I loved his material.
Yeah.
But there was also that aspect, is he going to lose it? It was fun, yeah.
You, this sounds like a Curb story, but it happened in your real life.
What's that?
You, in the time since the last Curb season, you spent a night in jail. You got arrested.
Oh, my God. What are you bringing that up for? I don't need that crap. All right. What are you doing to me? I spent a night in jail. Yes.
Okay.
Bring up a sad memory. Do you ever think a guy like me is going to end up in jail? But here's the thing I'm going to say to you.
Yeah.
Okay. I ended up in jail. It was a minor altercation.
Yeah.
And it really was. And I got put in jail because the woman had an expensive car.
Uh-huh.
And when I went in her window, she was making fun of me for being fat.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Weird, right?
Yeah.
And I don't have enough time to tell the story. This is what you do to me. To ask me a question, the entire segment will be... Do I have two segments tonight?
No, you don't have two segments.
I know. There's a novelist coming who maybe she'll write a book on my thing. Here's all I'm going to say to you, though.
Okay.
The reality is I hit on someone's window and said, why did you do that? You know, it was a dumb Larry David move because she was yelling at me and then I said, well, why did you make fun of me for being fat? It was the wrong time.
Yeah.
Anyhow, TMZ had me with a wrench busting windows and then leaping on her car and saying, you better call the coppers.
But that didn't happen. It was just this. You gave it a tap.
Not a tap.
Okay.
I'm a strong man. I didn't realize that strong. And, you know, like a window, it shattered, not on her, but like right there. And it was like, oh, when it happened, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
That's not what I wanted.
Did you know when it shattered? Did you how fast did you process? I might go to jail.
Not at all.
Okay, you still thought you were fine.
As a matter of fact, I went into the store to get my prescription. By the way, bought some Twizzlers. I'm diabetic.
Oh, wow.
And came out, and she was still there screaming for the police, even though I gave her my information.
Okay, gotcha.
And then the cops arrested me because they said, I said, why are you arresting me? They said, well, if she was driving a Toyota Corolla, you'd be fine. But it's a Mercedes S500, so we're arresting you for felony vandalism.
Ah, because it was a certain cost.
Yeah, exactly.
I will say that is a stone-cold criminal move to commit felony vandalism and then go buy Twizzlers. Really, the cops show up, and you're just eating Twizzlers.
By the way, which only led to more anxiety, and I was more scared because I had a sugar high.
Yeah.
And it was like, you putting cookies in the room.
Right, I did.
I'm bound to get arrested tonight.
So I have to ask, when you got to jail, were the arresting officers...
Okay, here's the key thing. All right, I see where you're going.
I'm not going
you
anywhere.
You heard the story. So I get to the jail... And I'm not going to do like what's her name did. Do you know who I am? You know, type thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Or anyone does that.
No.
That's not me. I wish I had done it now, though. Uh-huh. All right. So anyhow, I'm at the jail and all I'm thinking is, please, one of the police officers know me. Oh, we got to. Oh, Jeff, what are you doing here? We'll put you over here. Maybe we'll get you a cookie.
Yeah, exactly.
None of the cops knew me. Every criminal knew me. If you were handcuffed, you were thrilled. Oh, my God, what are you here for? I said, I just got a little felony vandalism. What are you here for? Oh, just robbed a family. You know. I love your work, you know, when I'm not robbing people.
Did you, not to obsess over the Twizzlers, but was that a situation where when you get there, they take it and put it in like one of those plastic things?
No. It was a big jumbo package.
Uh-huh.
It was gone by the time
they
took it away. As I was standing there, I was just downing Twizzlers. There was no bag to put it away. My son's earache medicine, yes, they held that for me.
Okay, well, that's very nice.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness, so you were going to get earache medicine for your son?
Yes, he had an ear infection. But they dropped the charges on the Monday, and I want to thank, by the way, Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, because the next day after I was released, I was no longer on TMZ because Northwest was born.
Oh, perfect.
So some people may have problems with them. I have none.
Yes.
I am thrilled with them. I love them. And you know what else? Can I have 1 second?
Of course.
This is like serious. So they dropped the charges, but the city wanted to meet with me. Mm-hmm. So my lawyer said, go take some anger meet with some for anger management.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't have anger management. I found out I don't have anger management. What I found out, and it's not a joke, is that I have an ego problem because I had righteous indignation.
Oh, yeah.
Like, why would she make fun of her being fat? It was over a parking space. So stupid. And I learned that ego does nothing for you. It's about being humble and being confident in who you are and what you do. But I learned a great lesson about ego and how it does me no good. And so I was saying, I wish I had said something. I'm glad I didn't say, do you know who I am or that I experienced this because, man, that ego thing, it's beautiful.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. So it was, in the end, a positive.
Very positive.
That's great.
And I would go through it again to learn that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for telling that story. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Sorry for putting you on the spot.
That's all right.
I love it. Jeff Garland, everybody. 19 with Kurt and Boogie on the Viewer Sunday Night Show.
Find that prior to doing the show, I realized I eat a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just sitting there thinking, like, boy, you're just grazing over everything, eating partial bars. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here with...
You're here with me.
This is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Jeff Garland.
Yeah, I'm Jeff Garland.
Hey, Jeff
From Garland. All Night and All Day.
We usually tape these after someone's interview on the show, but you've got to run right afterwards.
I'm going right to the airport, yeah.
It's before the show, and you were just telling me about your pre-show ritual.
Oh, not my pre-show. I guess. I've been eating a lot. They're snacks galore.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
When you do stand-up, do you have a pre-show ritual? Do you do anything to kind of get in a headspace?
Planning. What do I show up, like 5 minutes before and say hello to everybody? Yeah. I don't have any ritual.
Yeah?
I like napping.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. From listening to your podcast, you're a big fan of napping.
Mm-hmm. Napping and drinking water.
Very healthy lifestyle choices there, Jeff.
Those are. I also exercise. I actually work out every morning at 6 a.m.
Is that right?
Monday through Friday. I don't do the weekends.
That's really impressive. I also read this about your morning ritual, which I really like. You look in the mirror.
And I smile at myself. Because it's absurd. But I've learned at my age that the only thing you can ever do is be kind to yourself.
Right.
Like, I don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So I look in the mirror in the morning, I smile at myself, and I burst out laughing, and it sets a tone for the day.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
When you do stand up now, you tell your openers to bomb. Or they can bomb. Why is that?
How do you know this?
I read about you, Jeff.
I don't even know where that would be.
On the internet somewhere?
Yeah, well, maybe so. I don't even know where that would come from.
It's true? 100%
true.
All right.
I say, go up there and bomb. I don't care. I'm good with it. You'll still be open for me.
And is that just to let younger comics just learn from it?
Most definitely. Feel free. Enjoy yourself. Have a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you learn more from the stand-up shows that don't go well than the ones that do, or no?
No. I learn by just going up and trying, and some nights you can bomb, but it's the audience's fault, and sometimes you kill, and you weren't that great. So right. there's no rule.
Do you have a favorite type of comedy to perform? You act, write, direct, produce, do stand-up. You did improv in Chicago for a long time.
The most enjoyable is always stand-up.
It is.
Always, by far, yes.
What did you start with in comedy? Did you start with stand-up?
I was in college. First, I was studying theater, and then I switched to film, and then I started doing stand-up, and then I learned improvisation.
Nice. Yeah. And this was at Second City?
Yes.
And you were there with an incredible cast.
I there wasn't one particular. A lot of the great people.
Yeah.
Are you going to name somebody?
You talked to Colbert about it.
Colbert and I.
The box office.
We weren't necessarily in the same cast, but we worked in the box office there.
Who was in your cast?
I don't remember.
Well, you get back to Chicago a lot.
Yeah, I do.
I know you're a huge Cubs fan.
Huge. They just, matter of fact, some young people that I like at the Cubs called me today to ask me if I was coming for the playoffs.
Really?
But unfortunately, I'm filming the Goldbergs.
How hard is it to film the Goldbergs? Because you were filming the Goldbergs while you were filming Curb, is that right?
Yeah, both at the same time.
How challenging was that?
It wasn't.
And keeping up your Cubs fandom.
No, that was the easy part, the Cubs fandom. No, it wasn't. It wasn't challenging comedically. It was challenging emotionally.
Yeah.
Like some days I was just overtired and grumpy, but I did my job. Come on in.
Oh yeah,
I'm ready to be wired. I'm guessing that's the wiring.
Yeah, our stage manager Tom Bianca, who makes up our guest.
Are you here to wire me? Come on, Bianca.
Let's get Jeff wired up.
So you have about 6 minutes to your segment.
6 minutes till my segment.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be fantastic. Okay, so here, I apologize.
Are you looking forward to your interview tonight?
Am I looking forward to it?
Yeah.
No.
Not really?
No, I mean, I'm not looking forward to it. By the way, I like Seth.
Sure.
So I'm good.
Yeah, because you've been plugging or promoting the show for a good amount now.
No.
No?
No.
I thought you were somewhere today plugging or promoting
the show. Was I? Oh, I was at Facebook today. No,
You were at the Today Show yesterday.
Yes, and that's it.
That's a good amount of...
And I'll be back in October.
Yeah.
Playing Caroline's. When am I at Caroline's?
Oh, yeah.
19th through the 21st, October 19th through the 21st, and I'll be doing more press then. I do it. You know why I do press sincerely?
Please.
To be a good sport
for
HBO, for ABC, for the Goldbergs, for Netflix, like whoever I work with. It's part of the gig, man.
Totally.
But I like napping.
How many?
And I like doing stand-up. So I'd rather be napping or doing stand-up at any given time.
How many naps do you take a day? Or is it one a day?
I can do as many as two, but
as many as two.
Generally one a day. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of debate about how long a nap should be in the
20
day.
Minutes.
You agree that's...
But by the way, half hour is fine.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? 15 minutes is fine. But you don't want to do the hour, 2 hour, 3 hours, unless you haven't slept and you're just going down.
Yeah.
But under normal circumstances, not that long.
20 minutes.
Yeah. The power nap. Today I slept for an hour. I haven't gotten any sleep at night. So
yeah.
I sort of just come back to my hotel room and fall asleep. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, Jepper, we're really excited you're here.
Oh, well, thank
and
you.
I'm really excited for you.
Thank you.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I don't know what to expect. I'm going to go out and have a good time.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, I hope I'm great.
That'd be great.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's going to be good.
I'm glad you think so.
I think it'll be great.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Yes.
I'll see you out there.
You will.
We will.
You'll see me.
I'll be out there, too.
I'll be out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
This was fun.
Yes.
Thank you, Jeff.
Sure. My pleasure.
Our guest is a National Book Award winner and the author of the critically acclaimed novel Salvage the Bones and the memoir Men We Reaped. Her third novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, was published this month and recently made the long list for the National Book Award for Fiction. Please welcome to the show Jesmyn Ward, everyone. Welcome. I'm so happy to have you here. I want to talk about the book, but first, you have been on book tour for a while.
Yes.
Traveling around, and you have two children.
Yes.
I met your 11-month-old backstage.
Yes.
He was very sweet. He actually waved at me, and I was very happy.
Yep.
I don't think he recognized me, but he did give me a very nice wave. But you have a 5-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. and does she have an appreciation? Does she go when you're at bookstores? Does she see what you're doing?
She does. She actually she sees me signing books all the time.
Uh-huh.
And recently I walked in on her, and she had one of her books, and she doesn't know how to write yet or read, but there were all these random letters that she'd, written in the front of the book. And I went, wait, what are you doing? Why are you writing in the book? And she said, well, I'm signing the books like you. So I was like, oh, okay.
That's wonderful that you've taught your daughter to deface things.
Yes.
And she, you said she can't read, but do you think that in your daughter you have someone who's going to be a reader? Does she love books?
I think so. I mean, I recently went to the National Book Festival, and I was doing an interview with the Library of Congress, and I told this story about how when I was in second grade, I made this conscious decision that I loved reading, right? I was like, oh, all my classmates hate reading, but I love this. I love reading. And so I told that story during the interview, and then later that day she said, Mommy, do you like to read? And I said, yep, I love to read. And she said, I love to read too, Mommy. So yeah,
that's great. She's off to a fantastic start. This is such a beautiful book. It's a haunting book, at times a difficult book. You tell it through the eyes of three narrators, a mother, her 13-year-old son, and then there's sort of a supernatural element of a spirit of a 13-year-old from times past. Was that something, when you set out to write a book like that, do you know in your head, oh, I want to tell this three different ways from three different point of views, or do you sort of find that when you set out on it?
I mean, I knew that there would be, that I'd tell the story from two different perspectives, right? So from the 13-year-old mixed-race boy named Jojo and then his mom, Leonie. I thought that I might try to write, some chapters from Richie, he's the ghost, from his perspective, but I actually didn't do it. I wrote a rough draft, and then I revised it at least 15 times. And then I sent it to my editor, and then my editor said, well, have you thought about writing a chapter from this ghost perspective, from Richie's perspective? And I think that the reason that I hadn't, decided to actually go through with it and write from this third perspective is because I was afraid, because I'd never really written anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. From the perspective of a ghost, where I'd have to create an entire world and create a logic for that world, and it would all have to make sense and be really believable for the reader. And so when my editor said that to me, it was almost as if she gave me permission to do it, and it was almost as if she said, the subtext of her saying that was like, oh, I believe in you. You can actually do this. And so when she said that, that's when I decided to write those chapters from Richie's perspective.
And Richie's perspective, you have this character who is rooted in the past, and he is, he's based in a penitentiary. Mm-hmm. And this book sort of deals with this, sort of the racial history of this penitentiary, this mm-hmm. awful place. It seems, the characters in this book, even the 13-year-old boy, they are tied to the events of the past.
Yep.
And especially these days, it seems like when we talk about race, there are some people that say, I think it would be easier if we talked about race. If we just talked about this moment, it would be so much easier if we forgot about everything else that happened before that. But it seems to be that it's impossible to divorce the past from the present, and that must be something you think when you start writing.
I think about that all the time. I feel like that's one of the ideas that I'm obsessed with in my writing and that I return to in every book, because I feel like, especially in the South, Like, it's very clear to me that history bears on the present and that history has very real repercussions in the present. I mean, I was writing about Parchman Prison, which is an actual prison in Mississippi. It's like the Mississippi State Penitentiary. And that prison was basically, I mean, it was basically a plantation, right? The inmates were enslaved. They were whipped. They were made to work in the fields. They were rented out to industrial barons. I mean, you know, it's very clear to me, like, how the legacy of slavery expressed itself in Parchman Prison, right? When these inmates were basically enslaved. And I also think that, you know, that legacy has followed us today, right? I mean, I wrote a memoir about five young men, you know, who I knew, one of them was my brother, who all, you know, died in my hometown. And one of the young men who died was a cousin of mine, right? He the car that he was in actually hit a train, right? And I feel like it's no accident that happened, because I live in a poor, mostly black neighborhood, right? So I think the powers that be don't care about the infrastructure in that neighborhood, right? They don't care if, you know, if there are working signals, right, at that train crossing. They don't care if there's a guardrail at that train crossing, right? And so, you know, the underlying idea, right, behind that kind of treatment is that, you know, poor black people's lives are worth less, right? And so, and that's yet another way, right, that history is like bearing in the present.
And when you were from Mississippi, yes, and you went back.
Mm-hmm.
And you went back, correct me if I'm wrong, but you thought if you were going to write about these characters, you wanted to be in the present moment of the place that you were writing about. Was that incredibly useful to you as a writer?
It was useful to me, because I feel like it's important for me to be in the place and around the type of people that I'm writing about, because, you know, because it keeps me, I think, involved and keeps me passionate, keeps me committed, right, to sort of pushing back against, you know, the larger, you know, culture, which looks at people like the kind of people that I write about and really, you know, really, like, suppresses their voice, you know?
You obviously write, I mean, again, reading this, you know, it was beautifully written, and it made me think about a lot of things, but, you know, it was only, you know, a little piece of my time was spent, mm-hmm, in this world. Mm-hmm. I love spending it there, but you spend so much time, obviously, working, mm-hmm, on books like this. Like, do you have an ability to separate your work and the rest of your life so that you can think about other things? Is it possible?
Yes, it is possible. Although, when I'm writing literary fiction, I tend to avoid reading literary fiction because I don't want, you know, someone else's work to sort of bleed,
sure,
into my work.
Do you read anything?
I read everything. So I love reading, like, sci-fi.
Oh, good.
YA, fantasy.
Good. I'm very happy.
Romance. Yeah. I read all of those things because, you know, they allow me the opportunity to just, you know, get out of my head and get out of, you know, this, get away from, like, the weighty subjects that I write about.
Yeah.
And to just,
well,
like,
I will tell you personally, like, I feel like you've given us all a gift of letting us experience those weighty subjects, but I'm also glad that you can take time to, like, go to outer space.
Yes.
Because you deserve it. It's really just such a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Desi Ward, everybody, Sing I'm Very Sing is available now wherever books are sold, and everyone in the audience is getting a copy tonight. You're all going home with a copy.
Hi, everyone. This is Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage with Jesmyne Ward, who's the author of Sing, Unburied Sing. First, congratulations, because your book made the long list for a National Book Award fiction.
Yep, thank you.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
In this book, it's a heavy subject matter, and one of the main specific places that the characters go to is Parchman Prison, which is a real place, which you told me on the phone that some readers were surprised to hear that it was a real place. What went into the process of feeling as if you really wanted to include that specifically in the novel?
I knew that the characters would travel to Parchman Prison from the very beginning. Maybe part of the reason that I wanted to include it was because, you know, in Mississippi as kids, we grew up knowing about Parchman. And, you know, it sort of looms on the horizon. It's this place that you know that there's a possibility you could end up there, and it's a place that you know that you never want to go. And so I think that it, you know, that it looms so large in, like, the history of the state and the culture of the state, that I wanted to write about it, but I didn't know anything about it, but really before I began working on the book. And so, so I did a lot of research, a lot of reading. And one of the books that I read, was called Worse Than Slavery,
right.
By David Oshinsky. And that one was really useful because, you know, because it was not only was it about like the history of Parchman Prison Farm, but it was also about in some ways about the history, the early history of Mississippi, which I didn't know anything about that. Like Mississippi was considered the Wild West of the South.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like in the beginning, right before the state was really established, right? Mm-hmm. When that area was being settled. So I learned so much about Parchman Prison and about like how horrible conditions were for inmates, about how, you know, kids as young as 12 and 13, young black boys were charged with petty crimes and then sent to Parchman Prison. I learned that they were actually, I mean, they were enslaved again in some ways, mm-hmm. right? They were, you know, they had to work in the fields, in the farm, you know, on the farm. They were beaten with an actual whip that they called Black Betty. I mean, everything about this setup was basically slavery all over again.
Right.
And that was so, I mean, it was horrible. I feel like when I learned that history that I felt like a real responsibility to write about, you know, to write about the prison in like a really frank, sort of straightforward way.
And the prison itself, which I learned just based on researching you mm-hmm. for this show, I didn't realize about the convict lease system. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that is? Because I didn't know what that was.
Yeah, in the early days of the of Parchman Prison, the inmates would actually be leased out to industrial barons, right, in the region. So if some, you know, rich guy wanted, you know, 300 acres of his land cleared, then he would, you know, basically lease them from Parchman Prison, and they would send them out, and the prisoners would have to, you know, do that work. And it wasn't just, you know, they didn't just do that. They also laid railroad track, I guess, like throughout the South. And again, I mean, they had no choice
right.
in the matter. They had to do it in order to survive.
And so this type of research, you read another book that influenced your novel. Mm-hmm. Is that how you, because a lot of your novels in the next book that we talked about that you are writing, you're delving heavily into research material. Mm-hmm. How do you go about that? What's the process like for you in terms of gathering that information mm-hmm. to be able to write your books?
I sort of, it feels like stumbling around in the dark because I don't work with, I mean, I know there are really great research librarians out there. Mm-hmm. I do not work with any. I probably should. But I just, you know, I sort of cast around and see like what my friends have been reading about the subject. Sometimes it's all luck. It's all serendipity. Like I discovered the book about Parchman Prison when I was doing an event at SO1 Bookstore in LA, which is one of the oldest black bookstores in the country. And I was just like browsing because I always like to buy a book at every independent bookstore that I go to.
That's so great.
To support, you know, the uh-huh. bookstores. And there it was on the shelf. And so I picked it up and bought it. And then I read it. And so that happens too, you know, because I like to, you know, visit independent bookstores, and independent booksellers are really good resources because, you know, they know their books. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, you know, I'll ask them, you know, for recommendations or if they can sort of point me in the right direction.
Yeah. So your next novel, which mm-hmm. you've already started working on, mm-hmm. the setting is New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen, what you think is going to happen?
So it's set in New Orleans during the height of the domestic slave trade. And the novel actually begins in South Carolina.
Okay.
And the one of the main protagonists is a woman who is a slave, and she's being sold south. Right. And so she's basically going on. I mean, sometimes the slaves were actually marched south. So she's arriving. She will march. She will walk all the way from South Carolina to New Orleans, where she will then you know, be in the slave pens. Right. And this is an odd place for me to be because I've never written anything like this before. I've never written anything where the entire story takes place in the past. But I felt compelled to do this because I knew nothing about New Orleans during the height of the domestic slave trade. And one day I heard a show on NPR that was about like New Orleans history. And in that show, an expert was sort of was like, you know, saying that in New Orleans, you know, when it was the center of the domestic slave trade, that there were dozens of slave pens throughout the city, right? Dozens. And that this is where slaves were bought, were, you know, transported to, where they were inspected, where they were groomed, right? Where a certain narrative was created around them. And then, of course, then where they were sold, right? And mostly to work in cotton fields and to work in sugarcane fields and base in to be tortured and to die, you know? And so, and today there are only two markers of, you know, where slave pens were. And one of those markers is in the wrong location, right? And so I was just sort of struck by this, by the fact that, you know, that that history, that's the suffering of so many people had basically been erased, yeah. Right? I took Mississippi history in school. I took, you know, American history in school, and yet I had no idea. And so it's interesting to me that, you know, that as I mature as a writer and as I just mature as a human being, that that's where I'm being called, right? That I'm learning, you know, more. I'm learning more about, you know, about history and encountering these like forgotten stories. Mm-hmm. And then my impulse, right, is to pull them into the light and is to, you know, to make them known.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, where are the two locations?
I actually don't know. Oh. Yeah. I remember that from the report, but I'm
sure you'll find out know. With your research.
I was trying to get in contact with the I was at WWNO, which is the local NPR station in New Orleans. Uh-huh. And so I was trying to get in contact with the producer who created the show because I feel like she can put me in touch with the expert and then maybe the expert can take me around and show me some of these places. But yeah. I'll get there.
Lastly, in this novel, but also from your past novel and your memoir, what do you hope that people walk away with after reading one of your books?
I want the characters to live with the reader after they've closed the book. You know, I want them to live with the reader. I want the reader to think about those characters, you know, afterwards, for months, for years afterwards. And one of my biggest hopes is that when the reader encounters people like the kind of people that I write about and like those characters that they encountered in my work, that they see them as, you know, complicated human beings, right? Mm-hmm. That's my biggest hope.
Well, you definitely succeeded with this one. I think it's fabulous, and everyone in our office is reading it, so.
That's fantastic.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.